We are in 2 Samuel, and last week we got into chapter 19. We read the first 8.5 verses of chapter 19. So where we are is when David got run out of town by his son, and part of the reason I think Absalom did that is because of David's inaction when Amnon raped his sister. Scripture doesn't indicate that anything happened except David was angry. So when Absalom killed his brother and ran off to his grandfather and stayed there for a while, I think he was stewing. So he comes back and sets himself up, usurps the affections of anybody he can, and then goes down to Hebron, where he launches his rebellion. Hebron, of course, is the tribe of Judah county seat, and so he launches a rebellion from there. The rebellion eventually failed, and Absalom was killed. And then at the beginning of chapter 19, when Absalom was killed by Joab, David mourned him very loudly so that it robbed his troops of the joy of victory, because they saw that he was upset, and Joab then confronts him at the beginning of chapter 19, saying that if you don't get your socks up and get out there and act like a king, it's going to be worse than it was before. And so David pulls up his socks and goes out. So where we are now is verse 8.5 in 2 Samuel 19. Now Israel had fled, every man to his own home, and all the people were arguing throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines. And now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing the king back?" Obviously the deal is, all right, we all went with Absalom. That didn't work. David has otherwise been a good king. So why don't we think about bringing him back, is sort of the way it should read. And they're obviously arguing back and forth. And in any nation, there are going to be factions. Take, for example, the French Revolution, which got rid of the Bourbons and got rid of the aristocracy. Well, there was still, in fact, there probably still are Frenchmen who want the monarchy back. So the nation is united, if you will, under David, but it's not united in that it is not unanimous that everybody wants him back. You remember when he was fleeing, Shimei, who was a Benjaminite, ran along and threw rocks at him and cursed and all that kind of stuff, because he, as a Benjaminite, he was still loyal to the family of Saul. So when there seemed to be an opportunity to get rid of David and perhaps reinstate one of Saul's descendants, he was right in there. So that's the sort of conversation that's happening in all of Israel. What do we do now? Do we bring David back? Or do we find somebody else? And as I say, the argument is that he was mostly a pretty good king and he delivered us from our enemies. So why don't we go ahead and invite him back? So verse 11. "And King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Say to the elders of Judah, why would you be the last to bring the king back to his house when the word of all Israel has come to the king?" So this is a little bit of verbal jujitsu. Remember, I started off by saying Absalom launched his rebellion from Hebron, which is to say he seduced Judah. So in order to get back, David needs Judah. And so what he says is, "Hey, Judah, are you going to be the last ones to welcome me back? Because I've been receiving messages from everybody else in Israel. Do you want to be the odd tribe out?" One of the things I said, way early, and not original of me, obviously, is David is a really good politician. I don't know whether he is cynical and just knows how to do it, or whether he just naturally has a gift for politics. Sort of remember Bill Clinton. One of the things that he said is, once you can fake sincerity, you got it made. Just reading the scripture, I have no idea whether David is simply naturally good at it or whether he's being cynical and has studied it. But in either case, he does it very well. So he's coming back from exile, having defeated the rebellion. All Israel, in other words, everybody that was in the battle, has fled to their homes. So everybody is sort of melted back into the woodwork. Everybody except Judah is having this conversation of, well, okay, we put our bet on Absalom, that didn't work out. But David was a pretty good king, how about if we get him back? So David then parlays that into, Judah, are you going to be the last ones to ask me back? In other words, are you going to be the odd tribe out? So that's what's going on there. Verse 12, you are my brothers. You are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also if you are not commander of my army from now on in place of Joab. Understand that Joab is the guy that won the battle for him. But Joab is also the guy that killed his son. Furthermore, Joab is a power-hungry brute, to put it delicately. Because remember, when David was trying to unite the rump kingdom of Saul, which is the northern tribes, with Judah to make one kingdom, he offered Abner, who was Saul's chief of staff, if you will, the job. And Joab killed him. You remember there was a conflict, and Joab's brother was chasing Abner, and Abner kept saying, go back, go back, go back. And he wouldn't, so Abner finally turned around and killed him. So Abner has killed Joab's brother. So Joab lures Abner out of a city of refuge and stabs him under the theory that I am the avenger of blood. So legally and technically, he is innocent of murder. However, David doesn't think so. So what's going to happen now is David really doesn't care for Joab, but there's nothing he can do about it because Joab has the goods on him for murdering Uriah the Hittite. See, Joab is the one that did that. So Joab has got the goods on David, and he's also a power-hungry thug. So every time David tries to get rid of him by offering the leadership to somebody else, Joab sabotages it. And that will happen again here. So as David is trying to get Judah to lead him back as the king, what he does is he says, obviously, I'm the tribe of Judah, you're the tribe of Judah, we're bone of our bone and all that kind of stuff. And oh, by the way, I'll make Amasa the chief of the army. This is all political. Verse 14, and he swayed the heart of all the men of Judah as one man, so that they sent word to the king, return, both you and all your servants. So the king came back to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king and bring the king over the Jordan. So he's going to have a triumphal march from the Jordan Valley up to Jerusalem, and he's got an escort of Judah. Verse 16, and Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite, from Bahurim, hurried to come down to the men of Judah to meet King David. Now, Shimei is the guy that was running along and cursing and throwing dirt and rocks at him as he was leaving. Shimei is having a brown toga moment at this point because the king is coming back. Pick it up at 16 again now. And Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite, remember Saul's from Benjamin, the Benjaminite from Bahurim, hurried to come down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And with him were 1,000 men from Benjamin, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, with his 15 sons and 20 servants, rushed down to the Jordan before the king. So he's coming down, but he's not coming down by himself. He's bringing 1,000 Benjaminites. And I suspect the thing that is going through his mind is, I will throw myself on the king's mercy, and oh, by the way, there's 1,000 of my kinsmen right here. Do you actually want to kill me and start a battle, or can we let bygones be bygones? The other guy that's coming down is Ziba, who is Mephibosheth's servant. And you remember Ziba, when David was going the other way, came down and brought supplies to David. Mephibosheth stayed in Jerusalem. So David at that point said to Ziba, "Ha! All that your master owned now belongs to you, because you've been loyal and he hasn't." So Ziba's coming down, as is Shema. 18. And they crossed the ford to bring over the king's household and to do his pleasure. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. And he said to the king, "Let not my lord hold me guilty, or remember your servant did wrong on the day my lord the king left Jerusalem. Do not let the king take it to heart, for your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come this day, the first of all the house of Joseph, to come down to meet my lord the king. And, oh, by the way, take your sandals off so I can keep kissing your feet as I do all this." 21. Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, and Abishai is a brother of Joab. So Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered, "Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" But David said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be an adversary to me?" Now, the whole deal here is the sons of Zeruiah, who are Joab, Abishai, and Asahel, the one that was killed. The point is, these guys are highly political. They're always in the thick of things. And David clearly regards them as trigger-happy and thuggish. So when he says, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah?" he would really rather not have anything to do with them, quite frankly. So David said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be as an adversary to me? Shall anyone be put to death in Israel this day? For do I not know that I am this day king over Israel?" And the king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." And the king gave him his oath. So one of the things I've said is David is very sure-footed politically. So what he's doing is being very magnanimous as he comes back, especially to guys that can't do him any harm anymore. So what he's doing is he's showing his magnanimity and reminding them that he can be a very generous guy. 24. And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. He had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety. And when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" So remember, Mephibosheth, back at the beginning of all this, cynically said, "In this chaos, there is an opportunity for me to become king again." So what he's now done is made himself look like he's dragged through a knothole and going to give people the idea that he's been so worried about the king all this time that he hasn't taken care of himself and he hasn't eaten and all that kind of stuff. That's sort of the move he's making here. And so David says, "Well, why didn't you go with me?" 26. He answered, "Oh, my lord, oh, king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said to him, 'I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go with the king.' For your servant is lame. He has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Do therefore what seems good to you." So what he's saying is, Zeruiah lied about me. I asked him to saddle a donkey. He didn't do it. And I can't come with you on foot because I'm lame. And it's all his fault. And, oh, by the way, can I kiss your other foot? 28. For all my father's house were but men doomed to death before my lord the king. But you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I then to cry to the king? He's saying, I didn't do it, and if I did, I'm sorry. 29. And the king said to him, why speak any more of your affairs? I have decided. You and Ziba shall divide the land. And Mephibosheth said to the king, oh, let him take it all, since my lord the king has come home safely. 21. Now Barzillai, the Gileadite, right, now remember Barzillai is also one of the people who brought sustenance to David as he was fleeing. So Barzillai is his ally. Now Barzillai the Gileadite had come down from Roglem, and he went on with the king over the Jordan to escort him over the Jordan. So everybody is trying to get into this party escorting the king over the Jordan. Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old, and he provided the king with food while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. And the king said to Barzillai, come over with me and I will provide for you with me in Jerusalem. In other words, you deserve to be one of those who eats at my table. But Barzillai said to the king, how many years have I left still to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I am this day 80 years old. Can I discern what is pleasant and what is not? Can your servant taste what he eats or what he drinks? In other words, the fact that you're bringing me to eat at your table is a great honor, but my taste buds are shot, and I would just as soon go home and eat yogurt or whatever I can actually eat with my teeth or without my teeth. So can your servant taste what he eats or what he drinks? Can I still listen to the voice of singing men and singing women? Why then should your servant be an additional burden to my lord the king? Your servant will go a little way over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king repay me with such a reward? Please, let your servant return that I might die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. But here is your servant Chimcham. Let him go over with my lord the king and do for him whatever seems good to you. Chimcham is mentioned exactly 3 times in scripture. This guy twice and another guy named Chimchams, and we have no idea who they are. Speculation, with which I agree, is Chimcham is Barzillai's son. I suspect that's what's going on. But it is not scripture because there's no record of him other than his name. 38. And the king answered, Chimcham shall go over with me, and I will do for him whatever seems good to you, and all that you desire of me, I will do for him. Then all the people went over the Jordan, and the king went over. And the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own home. The king went on to Gilgal, and Chimcham went on with him. And all the people of Judah, and also half the people of Israel, brought the king on his way. Then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why have our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household over the Jordan, and all David's men with him? In other words, everybody is in kiss-up mode. So how is it that the guys from Judah snuck in here ahead of us, and they're the ones that are getting the honor leading the parade back into Jerusalem, when there are brothers and we should be right up there with them? Everybody's in kiss-up mode. 42. All the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is our close relative. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense? Or has he given us a gift? And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in the king and in David. Also, we have more than you. Why then did you despise us? Were we not the first to speak of bringing the king back, our king? But the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. The whole thing is kiss-up mode. They're all trying to get there first in line and kiss the king. All right, so we're on chapter 20 now. Now there happened to be there a worthless man whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjaminite. And he blew the trumpet and said, we have no portion in David, and we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. And this every man to his tents is a formula, which is to say, go home. don't be involved with bringing David back. Now, what I don't know is, you remember Shimei came down with 1,000 Benjaminites. And I don't know if Sheba was one of those who came down and has now made that speech to the Benjaminites who are with David and is going to take them up in rebellion, or whether he's somewhere else. I just don't know the answer to that. 2. So all the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, son of Bichri. But the men of Judah followed their king steadfastly from the Jordan to Jerusalem. So now we have a schism. Judah is staying loyal. Benjamin is going away. And the problem with Benjamin is Judah is the largest tribe. And Benjamin was originally set up to be a buffer tribe. You had Judah in the south and you had Ephraim in the north. Both of those two tribes had aspirations to rule, and both of those were the largest of the tribes. So Benjamin was put as a buffer between them. There isn't any prophetic anything about Benjamin being a king. So all he's doing is causing a schism here. Verse 3. And David came to his house at Jerusalem. And the king took the 10 concubines whom he had left to care for the house and put them in a house under guard and provided for them, but did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as if in widowhood. His son obviously has defiled his concubines. He provides for them, provides them a place to live, provides them food and all that kind of stuff and sustenance, but they are no longer suitable to be royal consorts. Verse 4. Then the king said to Amasa, to all the men of Judah together, to me within 3 days, and be here yourself. So Amasa went to summon Judah, but he delayed until a set time that had been appointed to him. And David said to Abishai, now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he get himself to fortified cities and escape from us. Remember, he's told Amasa that he's going to be the chief of the army. And so he's told Amasa, go get Judah. We need to get this guy, Sheba, before he can get into a fortified city and get a base established under himself and so forth. So Amasa, go get Judah. And then when Amasa is late coming back, he then turns to Abishai, Joab's brother, and says, go after Sheba and make sure he doesn't have time to settle and get into a city where he can set up a base of rebellion. Verse 7, and there went out after him Joab's men and the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men. They went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. When they were at the great stone that is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. So now Amasa, who knows what he's supposed to be doing, finally has got Judah, and he comes up there to join in the pursuit of this guy Sheba. Verse 8 again. When they were at the great stone that was in Gibeah, Amasa came to meet them. Now Joab was wearing a soldier's garment, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened on his thigh. And as he went forward, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, is it well with you, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand. So Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow, and he died. So don't ever get between Joab and power. The guy is a murderous, power-hungry thug. And as far as I know, Amasa's only sin is he wasn't fast enough gathering Judah to go north. There's no intimation here at all that Amasa was in any way going to be disloyal to David. Then Joab and Abishai's brother pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri, and one of Joab's young men took his stand by Amasa and said, whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab. So here you've got Judah, who has come up with Amasa. Joab has just killed him. So now the question is, to the Judahites, who are you going with? Are you going to be loyal to the king and to his king's commander, Joab, or are you going to do something else? That's the question. And given that Amasa is from Judah, and Amasa has been the one that led Judah up there, to have him suddenly be killed is naturally going to make the soldiers of Judah say, whoa, what's going on here? So he says, all right, if you're with me, come on, we're going to go. Verse 12, and Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the highway, and anyone who came by seeing him stopped. And when the man saw that all the people stopped, he carried Amasa out of the highway into the field and threw a garment over him. When he was taken out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. So what's happened is Amasa is lying dead in the middle of the street. This man of Joab's say, all right, who's going to be with Joab and King David? Let's go. So as the people of Judah come up, they all walk by Amasa and see Amasa dead, and every one of them stops like a bunch of people staring at a traffic accident. So you got a traffic jam, if you will, behind the body of Amasa because he's laying in the middle of the street. So this guy that is rallying everybody grabs him, pulls him off to one side, covers him up so nobody can see him, and then the parade moves on north. And Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Beth Ma'akah. Where Abel of Beth Ma'akah is at the far northern tip of Israel, just at the mouth of the Lebanese Valley. It is the farthest north city in Israel. Now, you remember several times ago, David, in fact, controls everything from the Brook of Egypt all the way up to the Euphrates. But this is the northernmost city that actually belongs to a tribe of Israel. 15. And all the men who were with Joab came and besieged him in Abel Beth Ma'akah. And they cast up a mound against the city, and it stood against the rampart, and they were battering the wall to throw it down. When a wise woman called from the city, listen, listen, tell Joab, come here, that I may speak to you. And he came near to her, and the woman said, are you Joab? He answered, I am. Then she said to him, listen to the words of your servant. And he answered, I'm listening. Then she said, they used to say in former times, let them but ask counsel at Abel. And so they settled a matter. Remember, she's now been identified as a wise woman. And so what she's saying here is, the reputation of this city is, if you need something settled, go up to Abel and ask, because the people there will give you a good answer. Verse 19, I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord? In other words, this city has a reputation for wisdom. We're peaceable. Why are you trying to destroy us? Joab answered, far be it from me, far be it that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not true. But a man of the hill country of Ephraim, called Sheba, the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city. And the woman said to Joab, behold, his head shall be thrown over the wall. We're not going to open the gate and let you in, but we'll send him out, or at least part of him. 22. Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they dispersed from the city, every man to his home. And Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king. So he isn't taking vengeance on all the Benjaminites who followed him. He just takes out the leader, and that's the end of it. Verse 23. Now Joab was in command of all the army of Israel, which is where he wants to be. And Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the Cherethites and the Pelethites. And Adoram was in charge of the forced labor, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahirud, was the recorder, and Sheva was secretary, and Zadok and Abiathar were priests. And Ira the Jairite was also David's priest. So David is now firmly back in the saddle, and everything is back under his control. So now, the rebellion's over, everything is settled and so forth. Now we're going to go on in Samuel, completely different time frame and completely different vignette. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David sought the face of the Lord. And the Lord said, "There is blood guilt on Saul and on his house because he put the Gibeonites to death." And you remember that the Gibeonites, when Joshua was leading the nation Israel to take over after the Exodus, you know, they come out of the wilderness, Joshua is coming in to conquer the nation. His instructions are, kill them all. Anybody you come up against, just kill them all. So the Gibeonites play a trick. And they put on old clothes, and they get some stale bread, and they get worn out sacks and so forth. And they come to the Israelites and say, "We have come from a far country. We've been traveling a long time. When we started off, these were new wineskins. When we started off, the bread was hot and fresh. And now look at it. We see that God is with you people, and we want to make a treaty." So Joshua, instead of consulting with the Lord, makes a treaty with them. And then they discover that they're the Gibeonites. So they're one of the people that they're supposed to destroy. So they make them carriers of water and hewers of wood, which is basically servants, forever. But they have made a covenant with them that they won't wipe them out. So the problem is, Saul has violated that covenant. Verse 2. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the people of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. Although the people of Israel had sworn to spare them, Saul had sought to strike them down in his zeal for the people of Israel and Judah. And David said to the Gibeonites, "What shall I do for you? How shall I make atonement that you may bless the heritage of the Lord?" The Gibeonites said to him, "It is not a matter of silver or gold between us and Saul or his house. Neither is it for us to put any man to death in Israel." And he said, "What do you say that I shall do for you?" They said to the king, "The man who consumed us and planned to destroy us so that we should have no place at all in the territory of Israel, let seven of his sons be given to us so that we may hang them before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord." The king said, "I will give them." So problem David has got is there's a drought. So he goes and inquires of God, and God says, "You guys broke your covenant with the Gibeonites." David goes to the Gibeonites and say, "How do we make this right?" And the Gibeonites said, "We want seven of Saul's descendants to hang." Now, a couple of things here. The only descendant of Saul that I know of that David gives a rip about is Jonathan. Jonathan's dead. I don't know that he has any particular affection whatsoever for any other person of Saul's lineage. The reason he took Mephibosheth in is because he was Jonathan's son and he wanted to do something good in Jonathan's memory. What we've seen up to now as we've read all this stuff is Benjamin is always sort of not here and there. Whenever there's an opportunity for Benjamin to maybe getting the monarchy back, they take it. So given that David has no particular love for the family of Saul, with the exception of Jonathan, and the fact that Benjaminites seem to be unstable members of his kingdom, the idea of taking out some of the people who might have a claim on the throne of Saul is probably not at all distasteful to him. Now, if it were not for the Gibeonites here, he wouldn't have taken them out. In other words, he's not just gratuitously going out and slaughtering them. But to get rid of the curse, and oh, by the way, get rid of a source of a rival claim to power in that process, I don't think that bothers him at all. I don't think he's just, "Oh, what am I going to do? I have to hand over some Israelites to these people. Oh, terrible." I don't think that's bothering him a minute. Verse 7. But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Saul's son, Jonathan, because of the oath of the Lord that had been between them, David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. The only thing that Mephibosheth has got going for him is Jonathan was his father. And David remembers that. Verse 8, the king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah, whom she bore to Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth. This is a different Mephibosheth. And the five sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom she bore to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Maholathite. This is Barzillai the Maholathite, not Barzillai that helped him out. So a different Barzillai. Verse 9, and he gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them on the mountain before the Lord. And the seven of them perished together. They were put to death in the first days of harvest, at the beginning of the barley harvest. So this is about Passover. Verse 10, then Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on a rock from the beginning of the harvest until the rain fell upon them from the heavens. And she did not allow the birds of the air to come upon them by day or the beasts of the field by night. So their mother is sitting there all during the harvest until the rains start, guarding the bodies of her children. Verse 11. When David was told that Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who had stolen them from the public square of Beth-shan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day that the Philistines killed Saul in Gilboa. You remember the Philistines killed Saul, took his head, and hanged his body on the wall at Beth-shan, and the men of Jabesh-Gilead went and got the bodies of Saul and Jonathan and buried them with honor. Because you remember, the men of Jabesh-Gilead were the first city delivered by Saul from, I believe, the Ammonites. I'm not sure if it's the Amorites or the Ammonites, one of the ites, who besieged the city. And so Saul's first official battle as king was to rescue the men of Jabesh-Gilead, and they never forgot it. So what David is doing is he's gathering up all the bones of Saul and his descendants, and he's going to treat them honorably. 13. And he brought up from there the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan, and they gathered the bones of those who were hanged. And they buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the land of Benjamin in Zillah in the tomb of Kish, his father. And they did all that the king commanded. And after that, God responded to the plea for the land. So he's cleaned up the problems of Saul. And, oh, by the way, in that process, he has, as far as I can tell, set it up so that Saul has no descendants. 15. There was war again between the Philistines and Israel. And David went down together with his servants, and they fought against the Philistines. And David grew weary. And Ishbi-Benob, one of the descendants of the giants, whose spear weighed 300 shekels of bronze, and who was armed with a new sword, sought to kill David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and attacked the Philistine and killed him. Then David's men swore to him, "You shall no longer go out with us to battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel." Now remember, I talked about that when he was at Mahanaim. And they told him, "You stay here, we'll go out and fight the battle." David is getting old, and he's no longer physically fit to be infantry. His soldiers know it, and they don't want him with them because he would be a liability. Somebody has to make sure that he doesn't get killed, as opposed to focusing on the battle itself. Verse 18. After this, there was again war with the Philistines at Gob. Then Sibichai, the Hushathite, struck down Saph, who was one of the descendants of the giant. And there was again war with the Philistines in Gob. And Elhanan, the son of Jaare-Oregim, the Bethlehemite, struck down Goliath, the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. What is happening here is, remember, Goliath was a giant. Goliath had four brothers. So what is happening here is we are cleaning out the giants that live among the Philistines. I don't know that these are Goliath's relatives per se, but the fact that they're taking down giants here is significant. Verse 70. And there was again war at Gath, where there was a man of great stature who had 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot, 24 in number. And he also was descended from the giants. And when he taunted Israel, Jonathan the son of Shimei, David's brother, struck him down. These 4 were descended from the giants in Gath. They fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. The idea there is that we're wiping out the giants. Just as a side note, when I was a child, my dad had a book. In this book, there were medical oddities. And one of the medical oddities was there were still people around who had 6 fingers and 6 toes. And I have recently become mildly sad that we don't all have 6 and 6. Think about it a minute. Instead of having everything be base 10, everything would be base 12. And 12 is a far more convenient numerical base than 10 is. It's divisible by 2, 3, and 4. It's a wonderful divisible base. And by the way, you know, the original length of the year used to be 360 days, which is divisible by 12. It's just a wonderful number base. God didn't agree, so we got 10 fingers and 10 toes, so we have base 10 number system. Comment was this chapter 21, with these battles with the Philistines and so forth, we're not really sure whether they're sequential with or not, but they are clearly not part of the story of the rebellion. They're after the rebellion because David gets told he can't go out to war anymore. So they're probably after the rebellion. In other words, by the time David is an older man. The comment was that it seems odd that Israel be cursed for something that Saul did as king this deep into David's kingship. But again, we have Mephibosheth is spared. So Mephibosheth is at David's table by this point. So it's been a while. As I say, there's no time stamp on these, I agree with that. But they do seem to be, when David is older and David is no longer personally out there swinging a sword, which is later in his reign. So do with that as seems good to you, but you're correct, there's no time stamp.